Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in D.C. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him.
Service Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in DC, and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. Lunch Agenda is a podcast that schools you on parts of the food system that are less often explored than restaurants and celebrity chefs. You can check out past interviews with DC food justice leaders like Dominique Hazard and Lola Bloom, and national food advocates like Mark Bittman, Marion Nessel, and Julia Tertian. All the interviews are on your favorite podcast app, and behind-the-scenes info and episode picks are at kikosfoodnews.com or KikoBuff on Instagram. February is a couple days away, and this year I will not stand by while others seize that month to celebrate Black history. I'm feeling inspired to spend the next few episodes of Lunch Agenda re-educating myself about some of the people, events, and innovations that have comprised Black history in America, of course looking at it through a lens of food. One of the reasons I'm drawn to this topic is because this is the first Black History Month since I became a teacher. And I'm lucky enough to teach a diverse group of students who latch on really naturally to lessons that raise up perspectives and experiences of other races and ethnicities and cultures. And I think it's my responsibility to incorporate some Black history into my classes next month. So I'm looking for ideas and tips in that way. But more importantly, I'm not sure if you all knew that this year marks the 400th anniversary of the transatlantic slave trade beginning in the United States. The first documented Africans to arrive in the English-speaking colony of what would become Virginia arrived in 1619, from of course, the west coast of Africa. And a 14-member commission has been created by the Secretary of the Interior to coordinate a commemoration nationally. And that commission includes leaders of the National Museum of African American History and Culture and the NAACP and more. But honestly, I have not been hearing about this moment enough. And I really feel we can't let a huge milestone like this pass us by. So over the next three episodes of the series, my hope is to uplift food traditions that traveled across the Atlantic, beginning with that first landing 400 years ago, and that evolved along with the African-American community sense and have shaped traditions for all of us. And it's my honor today to be in conversation with the one and only Michael Twitty, a culinary historian, food writer, and author of the James Beard Foundation's 2018 Book of the Year, The Cooking Gene. So I'm really looking forward to introducing Michael, who's joining me on the phone, thank goodness, because it's horrible weather out there. It's this gross, sleety, rainy mix in Washington, D.C. right now. But before I start talking with Michael, it's been a while since I've filled you in on food system headlines. So let's catch up on the last month with a little Kiko's food news. While we were away, the big news, of course, is that the government shutdown began and thankfully ended. The effects on the food system were dire, from the threat of federal nutrition assistance, food stamps running out, to food inspections that keep us safe happening less reliably. Luckily, there were bright lights as food organizations rose up to help those employees not receiving their regular paychecks. Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen set up right near the White House to serve free meals, and the Capillary Food Bank offered free pop-up markets for employees in this area. But the shutdown is over, at least for now, so we're going to look ahead and optimistically hope those challenges are behind us. Headline number one. A lot of food, actually, this is kind of, I noticed a bunch of food headlines at the turn of the new year pointing towards a meat-free foodscape. A few of those included Carl's Jr. launching plant-based burgers in 1,000 of their restaurants, the Washington Post predicting that banana milk, oh God, I'm going to butcher this, cassava flour and pea yogurt will be in our shopping carts this year, and Nestle even planning a vegan push with a no-meat burger and purple walnut milk. So, you know, that's been a growing trend, but just really gaining momentum as 2019 kicks off. Next headline. Two alarming studies published last month documented how Coca-Cola and other Western companies have helped shape Chinese food and beverage regulations for that entire nation. It showed that an organization funded by some of the biggest brands in snack food has offices inside China's health ministry and has worked to stave off food regulations and soda taxes. Coca-Cola actually tried similar tactics in the U.S. a few years ago, saying that exercise instead of dieting was the solution to the obesity crisis, and it was only after an outcry from public health advocates that it stopped those efforts. Next headline. Civil Eats shared a new report revealing how the growth of dollar stores in low-income and rural communities actually furthers inequity and pushes out local businesses. It sounds illogical, but their argument is that there are more dollar stores in the U.S. than all Walmarts and Starbucks combined. So Dollar Tree and Dollar General, for example, have expanded their footprint from under 20,000 stores in 2010 to nearly 30,000 stores as of last year. And they argue that these low-priced retailers offer little to no fresh food, but feed way more Americans than Trader Joe's or Whole Foods and other grocery chains. And they're gaining on the country's largest food retailers. And the report claims that dollar stores exacerbate economic and public health disparities, hurt struggling urban neighborhoods by staving off full-service markets from opening there, undercut small rural grocers when they're operating in a rural area, extract wealth from communities, and put the wealth into corporate headquarters. So that was just a really interesting report to read and to keep an eye on. And finally, I want to share an update from a very specific restaurant in New York City. A couple weeks ago, undercover police officers entered La Morada, a beloved South Bronx Mexican restaurant, and arrested the owner's eldest daughter while also threatening to arrest their youngest daughter, who actually had to be taken away in an ambulance after having a panic attack. The restaurant is owned and operated by a Oaxacan-born family, and it's been an anchor for its community for a decade. And although the New York Police Department didn't make a direct reference to the fact that the daughters are undocumented, the family suspects a correlation. And some say that this arrest is an example of how, even in a sanctuary city like New York, mass policing unjustly targets the working class. So I thought it was worth raising up that story just to draw attention to an issue that is obviously on so many of our minds. With that solid dose of news that took place over the past month since my last episode on the mic, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll be eager to introduce Michael Twitty and start asking him all about our topic of Black food history in America. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Lunch Agenda. I'm Kiko, your host, and you've tuned into the first episode of my new series, Black Food History Month. I want to put it out there at the get-go that there are a lot of topics to explore, of course, at the intersection of African-American identity, culture, life, and our food system. For example, in Lunch Agenda's Groceries for All series, the very first series on this show that happened exactly a year ago, we discussed the fact that in Washington, D.C., the neighborhoods that have the least grocery stores offering fresh foods are the ones with the highest proportion of African-American residents. There's a whole topic of discussion there. And then there was an interview that happened on the show with Julia Tershin, where we talked about how few farm owners in America are people of color and what we as consumers can do to shift that in our communities. But today, as we mark this 400th anniversary of the first documented African slaves landing in the American colonies, I'm hoping to learn from my guest, Michael Twitty, about legacies of African food culture that were imported into the U.S. along with those who were enslaved, and that have since shaped the experience of African Americans here and more broadly of all of us, lucky enough to taste and learn from them. Michael Twitty is a food writer and culinary historian personally charged with preparing, preserving, and promoting African American foodways and its parent traditions. He's a Judaic studies teacher from the Washington, D.C. area, and he publishes his thoughts in many places, including his website, Afroculinaria, and his award-winning book, The Cooking Gene. Hey, Michael, how are you today?
Hi, glad I'm not in the snow.
Exactly. And thanks for your patience. I know that on the phone, it's hard to wonder when are you ever going to get a word in edgewise on the show, but thanks for joining me.
No worries.
So, Michael, I want to say, you know, because you're my first guest in this Black Food History series that I've just begun, I hope you don't mind if I name a discomfort that I feel, which is that here I am, a white person, trying to create space for you and other Black people to share history and voice perspectives. But I also know that you've said, and I quote, healing may come from embracing the discomfort of the Southern past. So, end quote.
Right.
So in devoting this episode to this topic of Black culinary history, I'm here to learn from you, and I'm totally cool with you taking the conversation in a direction that I might not have anticipated. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, I'm known for that.
What did you say?
I said I'm known for that. It's no worries.
Uh-oh, okay. All right. I stand warned. So you wrote in a recent Bon Appetit article that, quote, I'm an African-American, gay, Jewish culinary historian whose life has been shaped by a search for my roots and an exploration of the ways food shapes identity, end quote. Michael, can you tell us a bit more about what led you to this work, to your extensive research on the roots of African-American cuisine?
It's a lifelong interest. It's hard to answer this question post-book, because it's like the book, half the book is like the answer. And it's like, how do I condense it? I don't know. The simplest answer I can give you is destiny. These are the people who I'm here to give voice to.
You said the simplest answer is what?
The simplest answer is my destiny.
Your destiny.
These are the people who I feel have been left voiceless, the enslaved, and the folks who were exiled on those initial journeys. And for me, they're very important because people tend to isolate them in our speech, in our narrative. They treat them as if they're so remote that they don't matter. But I'm like, without them, we have nothing else. So for me, detailing their journey and looking at my ancestors from that perspective is like the white light. It's the portal to something else, and an alternative key to our history.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think portal is a great image for you, you know, being on that journey of learning. And one of the things that I'm going to definitely talk about is, you know, the journeys you've taken in the South and back in Ghana to learn. One question I have about your work is whether you really focus on specifically the West African countries that, you know, that slaves were captured from and brought to the United States from, or whether you've studied traditions from all across the continent, and have focused research on.
So the answer is both, and I have since 2017, I've been to Ethiopia, Senegal, Ghana, Nigeria, Cameroon, and we are taking black chefs. We have a GoFundMe to take black chefs who have never been to the continent on our second culinary pilgrimage to West Africa. And this time we're going to Benin and Togo. By next year, I will have gone to back to Senegal, but also to Gambia, Sierra Leone, and Congo.
Wow.
So, to me, I'm making up for 400 years of lost time. And for me, it's very important to remember there is such an incredible similarity between the foodways of Africa, period. So, you know, forget the fake Sub-Saharan Africa divide, North Africa divide. Africa is Africa. And beyond that, we have to think about the migration patterns that took huge numbers of people, moved them from place to place, and essentially established maybe 10 or 12 blocks, which can be broken down even further, or broken down less even, just to say that, you know, Africa is a starch, a soup, a sauce, you know, some vegetables. You know, that's it. What's cool about traditional African foodways is that even though people of a certain rank may have access to more protein or more foreign goods or more alcohol, other things, essentially there's very little social stratification in the food. Huh. The king eats the rice and sauce just like the peasant eats rice and sauce. They both eat fufu.
Huh.
It's the same thing, and they both eat injera, and there is no difference. This goes from country to country, say the same exact thing. Everybody eats the basic staples.
Why did the social stratification not occur there?
That's our culture.
Uh-huh.
Our culture is not you eat this and I'll eat that. The culture is we're going to celebrate. Let's celebrate together. The culture is, let's eat from a common bowl. We're not going to eat from just individual plates with our own sort of, like, desires forward and everybody else is behind. No, we eat as a family. We eat as brothers. We eat as sisters. We eat as a crew.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between the king and the peasants is the amount of rice and sauce they get.
Right.
So it's very consistent. Now, the greens may change. In South Africa, they call it emisino. In Congo, saka-saka. In Senegal, they might make you moringa. They might make you sweet potato leaves. But the bottom line is everybody has the greens. Everybody has the hot pepper. Everybody has the okra. Everybody has the starch that, you know, sits in your stomach, makes you not feel hungry for a certain number of hours.
It's funny It's funny you bring up greens. I was just going to say, because I saw on a menu you cooked at Brownsville College last year that you served a dish called diaspora greens. And I just wonder, you know, how do you turn greens into a symbol of the diaspora? What did that look like?
You just use the basic elements. I mean, Brazil, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone, South Africa, you saute the greens with an onion. Onion, garlic. You add in bell peppers. You add in other things that are, you know, pretty common. I want the greens to look like any number of African flags. Red and green and yellow. And the, you know, the bitter pith to, you know, almost suggest blackness as well. So, but, you know, all those cultures have that basic saute greens recipe. And, you know, you can add a subtract to it, but it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, with pepper sauce on the side. So it's really, you know, just a matter of, you know, I look at it, you know, people are talking about Judaism and my Jewish side, and that's coming in the next book. But to be honest with you, I kind of intuited that in the same way that we as Jews in diaspora, and Jews in Israel too, I mean, utilize the entirety of what Jews have encountered and become in the world, I don't see it as problematic for Africans in diaspora to do the same thing. And we do. We already do that. You already hear the influence of salsa and merengue in Congo. You already know that Black Power has come to Brazil. You already know that there are rappers in Haiti. You already know that there are African Americans in Santa Maria Macumba. You know? Mm-hmm. All of us have we're not appropriating to this culture. We're participating in a global culture share that is part of the Black Atlantic.
I have to say, it didn't register until just now when you began talking about the Jewish diaspora that you're a double diaspora man. I can't wait to hear about how you kind of parallel those in your new book. What's the book called?
Kosher Soul.
Culture Soul?
Kosher Soul.
Kosher Soul. Oh, Kosher Soul. Okay. And when is that coming out, Michael?
We hope. the end of this year.
Okay, all right. So that's something to stay tuned to. Have you ever worked as a professional chef?
No. I'm not that organized. I've done pop-ups. I've worked in kitchens for specific programs. I haven't ever taken a salary for it. For example, cooking in different colleges for different programs, and hey, here's your home for the next 3 days is the campus kitchen, or here's this restaurant, we're here to help you out, that kind of thing. But never really working on a line, never really doing the whole process.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a dinner coming up in New Orleans this weekend, sold out, for a program by Radical Exchange called Resistance is Served. So my dinner is called Roots and Connections of Louisiana Cooking. So it's not going to be traditional Louisiana food per se, but it's going to be the foods of West Africa, the Caribbean, and the American South that parallel or conjoin with Louisiana foodways.
Really cool. So Michael, I first encountered you and your work about 5 or 6 years ago. When you were, I don't know if you were publishing or you were definitely publicly talking about the cuisines of the Gullah people who live along the coastlines of Georgia and South Carolina. And that mm-hmm. was a specific group that I hadn't learned about before. And I just think it would be really interesting for any listeners who aren't familiar with them and their specific food traditions, if you could just really quickly share a little bit about what makes that tradition unique.
Sure. What people need to understand is that at one point in time, and that's why I go a great length in the cooking gene to talk about migration, dates, people, places, laws, because so many people, they think that Black history is just this big blur. And I'm gonna put it in the most facetious, sarcastic way. Hey, there were some people living in the jungle, and they didn't have much going on, so the white people came and gathered them, gave them a job, couple hundred years and gave me basketball, and then I became rich and everybody's great. Oh yeah, Dr. King. That's the Black history most people learn. And it's complete bullshit. Because it ignores our women. It ignores our gays. It ignores our poor. It ignores the fact that the degradation we face was more than just what water fountain you could use or what seat on the bus you could take. The incredible diversity of our people is obliterated. And every bit of the 2 steps forward, 5 steps back that Black history often was, and in some cases is today. So I think it's really, really critical that we reinvent that narrative to talk about we're more complex than you think we are. We're not an easy study. We're not an easy write-off. And some people think that. So when we talk about the Gullah Geechee people, what we're really talking about is a remnant of what used to be the entire South. All over the South, you had varying degrees of connections to a deep African cultural structure, even if the surface structure appeared to be assimilated. There was a deep African cultural structure. The difference is that in the Sea Islands and in the nearby coast, the ecosystem, where rice was grown, Sea Island cotton, indigo, was very unhealthy for people of Northern European descent.
Hmm.
So what they would do is they would migrate around. They would live, sometimes they'd live with Northern relatives during summertime. Sometimes they would live in the cities during the spring, or live on the plantations during wintertime when there were no mosquitoes. But their world was preserved by the fact they had a unique skill set that could not be duplicated elsewhere. In other words, you couldn't take those skills and move them to another location because those crops could only grow there. Number two, they couldn't import any more people. They had to rely on who they had. Number three, the environment helped them maintain their culture because they had to be separate.
Right.
You know, they were living in malarial swamps. Unlike people who lived in Maryland and Virginia, who basically get sold off to the Middle South, people from Louisiana and the Lower Mississippi Valley who get sold up the river and over, you know, into Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, et cetera. And so all these people are being, you know, moved around, except for this one group of people who maintain the language, which probably is more representative of early Black English than we think. Hmm. You know, they used to treat the Gullah like they were this extraordinary cultural isolate. It magically appeared, and my theory goes like this. No, they're probably an endangered Black culture, because they represent what all of our ancestors used to be, which is very deeply rooted in Black African spirituality, African language systems. You don't have to always have the vocabulary for every single word. Sometimes the syntax matters, because the syntax is where the intellect and thought of a culture are in terms of its language. So, you know, these rice-growing, rice-eating people whose roots are, you know, easily traceable to Congo, to Sierra Leone, to Liberia, to Senegal, to Ghana and other places, have had a really long-lasting impact on all of us, and certainly is a big part of my family roots in South Carolina.
Yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me of, you know, learning about Japanese culture and how its geography, you know, dictates its unique attributes. But yeah, it makes sense. All the reasons that you're saying that it was the least diluted and most preserved. So I think that that's just like a really special body of your work. You wrote on your blog, Afroculinaria, soul food is flexible, it is vegan and omnivorous, it has a particular and powerful history and an extraordinary future. Soul is not fast food plus junk food plus Southern Black cooked unhealthy comfort celebratory food. Soul food is a tradition and a narrative that is ennobling. Soul food is a love letter to the spirit and stomach. Soul food is cultural power and capital. Soul food is a crown, end quote. Michael, is it safe to say, or take away from this, that soul food is your favorite African-American food genre to study?
Yes.
Okay. So I, you know, I know that there are whole podcasts about soul food. There's so much I could ask you about soul food on this show right now, but I'm curious to specifically ask you to explain, you know, which parts of soul food, today's version of what Americans consider soul food, was most directly derived from, you know, the legacy of what Africans brought over, you know, beginning 400 years ago, versus, yep, you know, what have been created here?
All the vegetables.
Okay.
All the vegetables. And that's the thing that kills people. They're like, oh, they're like, it's the vegetable. I said, yeah. I said, we come from veggievore cultures. You know, there's not a whole lot of meat over there. There's more fish and smoked fish than anything else. Now, when you enter into a British and German and French-based, you know, culture, right, you're going to be having a lot more salt pork and pork to replace that fish. You know, they did herring, but it wasn't the same herring. You know, they had pickle herring. We had smoked herring. We had smoked fish. Hmm. But it's the same kind of, like, must have that smoked umami flavor.
Right.
In the food.
Must have.
And, it was like a seasoning. It wasn't really like an entree. You know what I'm saying? So it wasn't like they had, the meat was the center.
Yeah.
You know, meat took labor and time and energy that was not easy to come by when you're doing other tasks. And I have to, you know, reiterate this, that one of the things that we came from were societies where everybody had a task. Everybody had a certain labors assigned to them because they were specific to your age, your gender, your rank in society. Sometimes some West African societies, for example, those in Senegambia had castes. So everybody had their thing. And hunting was a very specific thing. Domestication of animals and animal husbandry and transhumanism was a very specific thing. But these were not great meat eaters. Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. They relied on their vegetables. They relied on their legumes. They relied on their fresh greens. And they relied on a lot of seasonings and spices to vary the diet from season to season.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Leah Penniman, who's going to be a guest next week on the show in the series, has a quote in her new book where she says, "Too often we're told that healthy cooking and food preservation is a white people thing, when in fact the unhealthy aspects of our cuisine resulted from the deprivations instituted under slavery."
Right.
You know, you guys are totally talking about the same thing. You know, meat was used as a spice. It wasn't like the big hunk of meat on the center of the plate. So then why did that evolve that way, though? Why do so many Americans think about a big hunk of fried chicken or fried fish in the center of the soul food plate?
I'll tell you why. Number one, we can enjoy it now. We enjoy it with relish. Here's a bigger problem. This is where you can't run away from race. There is this unfortunate idea that the well-fed, happy African-American is probably doing something wrong. I'm going to repeat that. The well-fed, happy African-American is probably doing something wrong. She's a thief. He's a criminal. He's overfed. He's overprivileged. He's overblessed. He doesn't know a hard day's work. Why does he get to eat that and I don't? See, why should he have a Cadillac and I still got a mule? Or why does he want a mule when he's still walking knowing I should have a mule? We've been dealing with this nonsense for centuries. That I should be better than you. If I'm not better than you, then who am I? If I don't have a better life than you and your deprivation, who am I? See how they get fat and happy off of our dime? That's the myth that they're telling in Brazil right now under Bolsonaro. You know, the favelas, are full of fat people. Mm. You know, not forgetting that the people who are in the favelas, their ancestors and them, built Brazil. Made it at one point one of the most extraordinarily rich places, one of the richest places on the face of the planet. But there's that idea that, you know, when Michael Brown is shot in Ferguson, Missouri, a meme, you know, spread over the internet, and I commented on my blog, and the meme was his corpse surrounded by KFC and watermelon and Kool-Aid. It's that image of they don't deserve. And see, this is what they do with their welfare money. And this is what they do. All these awful, grotesque, actually meaningless stereotypes.
Yeah.
But it also goes to the idea of these people have no self-control. These people have no values. They're not good Protestants like we are. One of the Protestant values is temperance and balance. And if there's a hunk of meat on your plate because you worked hard for it, and you deserve it because you did nothing but work. Hmm. So it's a war of the lenses. The lens of you know us being just regular human beings, everybody else, and the war of the lens of us being the example of a constant cultural pathology in action. And of course, you know, as you well know, the Dinesh D'Souza's of the world and other right-wing pundits have made it their career to basically create the idea that all of black culture is pathology, including the way we eat.
So let's talk about a term that I've heard you use that, you know, I've talked a lot about food justice in my work. That's pretty mainstream now. And then there's a term nutrition justice that is something that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, access to nourishing food, equality of access. And you use a phrase, though, culinary justice. What does mm-hmm. that mean to you?
Culinary justice, you know, I remember the first time I really felt the usefulness of the term was when I was challenged on it by a sister who was doing food justice work in the Philadelphia area. And she says, well, I think it's kind of elitist to talk about culinary justice when you don't have food justice to begin with. And I said, my sister, I said, if all you have is rice and beans, your rice and beans is delicious, and somebody tries to jack it, and you can't have uplift because of that rice and beans, you do need some culinary justice. Just flowed right out of my mouth. Like, no, we have good stuff. We have good stuff because how we survive our oppression is our greatest form of cultural capital.
Sure.
That's what makes us special. And you know, when I say the words black, gay, Jewish, that's not just, oh, that's a whole lot of layers. That's three cultures that have had to shine despite oppression, despite violence. And how we've shined and how we've flourished is based on our ability to get the hell back up and keep shining. And we do that with our food all the time. And then you know, next thing you know, a chopped cheese gets to go to some high-end market or some high-end restaurant when a chopped cheese wasn't nothing but a bodega sandwich.
What is a chopped cheese sandwich? What is a chopped
in
cheese?
In New York. It's kind of like, you know, burger and lunch meat, lettuce, onions, special sauce, you know, thing on a hoagie to get for a couple bucks at your neighborhood deli bodega.
Okay.
Poppy's.
All right.
And in New York, that's a big thing. And then all of a sudden, one day, somebody was like, how the hell did a chopped cheese become $14? Hmm. You know, you can't upscale a chopped cheese. You know, no, it's a nice try.
So that's the idea of culinary injustice, is when a dish or a cuisine becomes inaccessible?
Inaccessible, out of reach. And, yeah. And look at that word inaccessible for a moment. You hit it on the head because we're not just talking about monetarily inaccessible, culturally inaccessible.
Right. Okay.
Like when we have these barbecue shows on TV and ain't got no black men, or very few, which inculcates the idea that barbecue is about the Bubbas and not the brothers. When you and I both know that's not the history of American barbecue. American barbecue is very black and brown, very native, very African, and very Latinx.
Right.
And so, it's the whole history of, you know, Mexicans being pushed across the border and then there's a wall. It's the whole history of Jim Crow. It's the whole history of the Trail of Tears. The whole history of Columbus as initial contacts in the Caribbean. That's the sucky part that underlies all of it. And it's there, and it's not going anywhere. So, to making the history inaccessible, it's also making the brick-and-mortar bank loans for restaurants are accessible to chefs of color, making it so that you get to eat his hot chicken but not his hot chicken because you're scared to go to his neighborhood because redlining and imbalanced policing and imbalanced, you know, funds for certain neighborhoods make it inaccessible. So the word inaccessible is the greatest word ever to describe culinary injustice. Right. But when we make those... And also, it's making the traditions inaccessible to the very people who created them, by which they can create uplift. I mean, one good example of culinary justice is when folks were working with the people down in Sapelo Island to farm sugarcane that was from the island that had developed there to make different products from it. So, in other words, you get to keep the land. You're paying off these property tax to keep the land and the family. You keep the tradition going. It's explained to your children what you're doing. Children grow up knowing that life, being part of the land and the water, is a noble life. And their people have been doing it for centuries. They have a heritage now. and they can relate to the outside world on equal terms because they own who they are from stem to stern. That's culinary justice.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms, Michael, of access to the history and to, you know, and power of claiming, you know, the food traditions, let's talk about some opportunities that you see happening in America and that you think our listeners could even get involved with. So, for example, I saw that you're making a film about your pilgrimage, maybe to Ghana specifically, or your various trips and the transition of African food across the Atlantic. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Sure. Yes. And I don't want to be crass, but we do have a GoFundMe.
I was going to bring it up. So, yeah, tell us where it is.
Called Support Our Culinary Pilgrimage to West Africa. And there's a beautiful picture of one of our tour members, Jasmine, helping to sort, clean, and prepare fish in Accra, Ghana. She was part of the first trips going back to the next group to not only participate but to also to act as a liaison, because what I would like to do is have a few holdovers from each trip go back to reach and teach the next group.
That makes
so
a lot
and
of
so
sense.
Forth.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because it's a beautiful, wonderful experience, okay, to go to the continent. But it's also very trying. You've never been. There's a lot to deal with. There's a lot of emotional, joyful, sad, stressful, complex things you got to deal with. So for several of our past members are going, but it's going to be largely people who have never been to Africa before at all. And so for them, there's a lifelong dream of reconnecting with their West African roots. And the GoFundMe will help support them. We are on my Twitter handle, Kosher Soul. My pinned tweet is a link to that GoFundMe. We're almost there. We're almost there, guys. Please, 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 just push us over the edge. We're going to be so happy. We're bringing Casey Wright, who is a great upstart filmmaker I met on the trip to Cameroon I just took. And Casey's really good at capturing those really important moments of reconnection. She has a drone, and the cool part about the drone is...
Oh, man, drones.
We were in Cameroon.
Nobody had seen one. I have a conflicted relationship with those.
Yeah, it's really complex, and... You know, there's a lot of issues there. I get it. But one of the coolest things ever was when she took drone shots of the market. And, the kids had never seen one. And they were absolutely thrilled. They were like, they thought it was a grasshopper, and it was cool. So it was like, look at the grasshopper. the electric grasshopper. And they just couldn't stop looking. I mean, we were charming. The whole group was of boys and girls were just like, wow, that's cool. I want to do that. So that was really fun.
So when would the trip?
We're going to do that March 8th through March 18th.
Okay.
About 10, yeah, 10 hefty good days. It takes a lot out of you, too. We're going to go to markets, and we're going to help pull the fish in at the ocean. We're going to make palm oil and go to a sustainable farming project called the Songhai Project. We're going to go to traditional religious shrines. We really are getting into the heart of healing, health, spirituality, and food on this particular trip.
Cool. So we can look out for that video probably on your website, right? Eventually.
We're going to try to do the blog and YouTube. But again, we need the funding to get that under control.
Right.
Because we want to make this free and accessible to everybody. And as you know, that doesn't come easy. That's not something, oh, it's nice that they did that. No, it takes a lot of money and sacrifice. And so we're encouraging people to help push us over our intended budget, yeah, and our threshold for this for raising money, but we're so excited. This is the first time anybody's done anything like this.
Yeah,
and you know, it'd be great to have an Ava DuVernay budget. You know what I'm saying? But we don't. But that's okay, because I've always believed in doing, you know, the best that you can with what little you have, and get a good start.
Well, I trust some listeners to look this up, and I'll put the link on my Instagram too. So hopefully that will help a little bit. You brought up markets, and one of the other things I wanted to ask you, for those of us who want to, you know, dig into some of the recipes or ingredients that you've been talking about today, is what tips do you have if we've been inspired to cook some of these dishes? Are there any African markets, if we live in the DC area, that you recommend we check out? Are there any grocery chains nationally that have a really great African food selection? You know, just a couple tips.
Yeah, they're not a whole lot, but in DC, you know, you're surrounded. I mean, just take a, you know, let your fingers do the walking on your smartphone, and then call and ask. And, you know, think about ingredients. Go shop with ingredients in mind first, as opposed to, okay, I want to make some jollof rice. Well, that's a big argument over what goes into jollof rice. And also, know that there is a certain kind of Americanization or Westernization that takes place in mainstreaming African dishes, because they're very strong. They're very strong with palm oil, very strong with pepper, and very strong with smoked fish.
Sure.
The building blocks that can be. So you really have to treat those things as, you know how, you know, fish sauce, you're cool with fish sauce now, but like fish sauce when you start was like too strong for you?
Sure. Yeah.
That kind of deal. You have to kind of like ease on down the road when it comes to some of these key ingredients. And learn how to use them in balance. For example, for me, palm oil is never, I never use as much palm oil as they say, because I can't, my system just can't do it.
Yeah, palm oil is intimidating to me. I've never cooked with palm oil.
Yeah, it's really heavy and it stays that way. And so I say, I'll just use a tablespoon or two to get the color.
Mm.
And a little bit of the flavor. And then it's perfect. Absolutely perfect. So that way you get both parts of the deal without it being full on, you know, Diwala dinner time, you know, for rice, you know what I'm saying? So you have to really kind of ease your way into it. But it's
sure,
all good.
Sure. And is there such thing as an African pepper soup festival around here? Have you heard about that?
No, I have not. I have not. I know there's a festival in New York, but they've just started Afro Foods Festival up there. Then again, hey, I'm sure somebody out there is going, oh, yeah, I know about that.
Sure.
Hopefully they'll let us all know where it is.
Two other things that I've heard about as I've been researching for the series. First of all, the day I read your article in Bon Appetit about your visit to Ghana and experiencing the Chop Bar, I met a man who co-founded a Chop Bar pop-up in D.C. So that's something that was really cool to learn about. And, you know, people can check out District Chop Bar. Because that scene just feels so unique in the energy of a Chop Bar. He describes it like Cheers, but with different food and different drinks. Star beer instead of Guinness. So that's cool. And then Dine Diaspora. Are you familiar with that group?
Yeah, I did a program for them one time.
Cool. So if you live in the D.C. area and are interested in tasting these foods, learning to cook with some of the traditions that Michael's talked about, I encourage you to check out Dine Diaspora, which was founded pretty recently, I think. So, Michael, I ask every guest for an action item before an interview ends, and that is anything that you would ask listeners to do to change our food system in a way that you think it needs to be changed. What's one little thing that you ask us all to do?
One little thing. For me, that one little thing would be to figure out ways to increase the amount of public land on which the average person can grow something. Especially, you know, here where a lot of our land is federal owned. And it's hard for people in the immediate city of Washington or nearby areas to just have land to grow something on. And to me, it's so critical that all of us have access to the land and water.
Yeah.
So that we can be stewards. So that we can take ownership and be responsible to pass them on to the next generation better than we found it.
Yeah. I know. I think I need to do a whole series about land reform in America. That's something my sister has been telling me to do for a while. And there has been so much, actually in Leah's book, I've learned about restriction of access to land and land loss that has specifically affected the African-American community, of course, but I like your statement that access to land and water is just the most basic way to have agency in our lives and food lives. So thank mm-hmm. you. That's an action that no one else has offered on the show so far. So, wow. Michael, I'm grateful for you being my first guest in this series. I honestly am leaving with a lot more questions than I came with. you know, I'm now curious about, I didn't know palm oil is really a color changer in a recipe, and I need to go check out a cheese chop sandwich, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as you say, it's interesting because on the one hand, you talk about the consistencies in the African food traditions and how, you know, I love your point about the lack of social stratification. On the other hand, it's clear that there is just endless different adaptations and ingredient choices and you know, different flavors to try in this type of cuisine, or cuisines plural. So thank you for just giving us a little taste of what there is to dig into here. And one more time, tell us the GoFundMe.
So GoFundMe is, please support our culinary pilgrimage to West Africa. And again, you can find a link to it on my Twitter, Kosher Soul, or my Facebook page, Michael W. Twitty.
And then Michael's at The Cooking Gene on Instagram. And yeah. Thanks again. I hope to meet you in person sometime since we're not too far away. And to the listeners, stay tuned for next week's episode. As I said, it will be an interview with Leah Penniman, the founder and leader of Soulfire Farm. And that'll be a really dynamic interview about African traditions that have shaped agrarian practices in the United States. And I'm really looking forward to that conversation. So talk to you next Tuesday. This is Kiko on Lunch Agenda, and thanks for tuning in. Night, Michael.
Thank you.